From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. For the rest of the hour, we'll be talking about nanotechnology and where it stands today. It's a field that's received a lot of attention and lots of press, even though scientists are still just beginning to develop the techniques and tools that will be needed to put it into practical use. This week, the journal Nature published a paper about a vibrating tube of carbon. Imagine a tiny guitar string. Is this the harbinger of tiny orchestras? Well, probably not, but it is important. And here to explain why it's important is the man who published the work describing this carbon tube vibrating. Paul McEwen is a professor of physics in the Laboratory of Atomic and Solid State Physics at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. He joins me from a studio there. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. McEwen.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. So, Dr. McEwen, what is this vibrating tube? What makes it a nanotube, first of all? Is it just by the particle size or the size, or is there some other qualification that you have to be called a nanotube?
So there are lots of things that people give the name nanotube to. Basically, it's a very, very small diameter tube. You know, imagine a soda straw, but shrunk down to where it's only, say, 10 atoms across in size or something like that. And these particular tubes that we're using are called carbon nanotubes because they're made entirely out of carbon atoms. And really what they are is, you probably have heard about graphite in various contexts. It's the stuff in pencil lead. It's actually made up of atomic-like sheets of paper. Think of a stack of paper where each paper is one atom thin, a sort of chicken wire mesh of carbon atoms. If you took one of these sheets of paper and coiled it up to form a tube, again looking like a soda straw, you'd have a carbon nanotube. And that's the string that is on our guitar.
I see. And okay, so is guitar the term you like? Is there a particular reason to pick guitar over viola, for example? Or is this just a vibrating string?
It's a vibrating string. It's a very simple musical instrument, which is not a musical instrument, but it's only got one string, so you can call that whatever you want.
I see. And what are the physical qualities of a vibrating carbon atom that you can use to describe it as a guitar string? Is it make it pitch a tone if you could listen at the proper frequency?
Yeah, so like a guitar string, it is like that in the sense that it's clamped down at both ends and vibrates just like a guitar string vibrates. And you can pluck it and it will vibrate at various tones. There's the fundamental and the harmonics, just like there are with a regular guitar string. And you're absolutely right. If you have the right kind of ears, you can listen to this tone, although the frequency of the vibration is maybe 1,000 times higher than anything you could hear with your ear.
So apart from being incredibly cool and amazing, is there something, you know, that makes this a technologically or even scientifically, you know, important step in nanofabrication?
It's a nice step forward because it allows us to make what we think is, you know, one of the, if not the smallest, little oscillator that people have ever made. And you know, what might you want a little oscillator for? And there's a number of possibilities. Perhaps the one that we're most excited about in the near term is that you could use it to weigh things. And the way that would work is, imagine you had a guitar string and you glued to it a little piece of weight, you know, a fishing lure or something like that. That would shift the frequency at which it vibrates. And the heavier it was, the more it would shift the frequency. So if you listen for that change in tone, you could infer the mass of the little stuff that you attach to the nanotube. And since the nanotube is so small, it doesn't take very much mass to change its frequency by something that should be a measurable amount.
And the questions always come to mind. I mean, I appreciate that you could do this, but is there a reason to want to do this?
Very good question. We get out of bed in the morning just to try to do crazy stuff that people have never been
well,
able
you know,
to do
you
before.
Know, you're fulfilling a lot of people's fantasies here by saying that. But I appreciate there are. I mean, people have been using nanotechnology in interesting ways. But I mean, this is one of those things where it's, you know, as a layperson, you think, you know, it. Well, I'm sure there's a good answer, so that's why I've asked you instead of my speculating on the question.
No problem. So now I will speculate, because we never know what anything's going to be good for. But let's go back to that mass-determining thing. Let's say that you could glue a molecule onto the nanotube and its frequency shifted by an amount that you could measure very accurately. You could, in essence, weigh a molecule and learn something about its chemical composition. In the last interview you had, you were talking about using mass spectrometry to measure small amounts of something. Well, this might be the ultimate limit of that, where you could weigh an individual molecule and maybe from that infer what molecule it was.
Wow. So in other words, just going back, we were talking about capturing bits of the solar wind. You could take a piece of the solar ion somehow and weigh it with this string, like this tube?
One would hope. Of course, there's the small problem of taking the molecule you want to weigh and dropping it onto the tube. That's why we haven't done it yet.
Right. Well, that's the nano tweezers, isn't it? I guess.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, so I'm just curious. Cornell has been at this nanotechnology game for quite a while. It seems to me I remember coming up there in the 80s and coming to a nanotechnology fabrication center. Is Cornell a particularly big player in this field?
Certainly, we have what is probably the premier nanofabrication facility in the country for a university. In fact, we just doubled its size and put it in a brand new building here. Cornell is interesting in that it's been committed to nanotechnology for 20 or so years, as you said, long before it was the fashionable thing to do.
I see. We're talking with Dr. Paul McEwen of Cornell University about a small tube that he's created that can be actually plucked like a guitar string. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call right now. Let's go to, is it Vimvent in Minneapolis, Minnesota?
Yes. I'm a student of nanotechnology in a new program we just started here in Dakota County Technical College.
Uh-huh.
In Rosemont, in Minnesota. And I'm calling because I have a question for the doctor. First, let me say, doctor, I enjoy your work. And I'm very glad because I have always enjoyed people from your school, like astronomer Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is this. How long will it be before we get a nanorobot fully operational? And in view of the forces involved at nanoscale, and I'm talking of mesoforces like Brownian motion, van der Waals forces, and quantum mechanics, do you think we can successfully get a nanorobot to do the stuff we see in science fiction, like go into the bloodstream and repair the system?
Well, that's an interesting thought. Dr. McEwen, are you prepared to speculate on that question?
Oh, sure. Speculate is always fun. Well, we know it can be done because it's been done. Our bodies
really
are full of nanomachines that do exactly that sort of thing. Viruses come and attack us and our immune system responds and what have you. These are all nanometer scale machines that have somehow figured out how to work at that scale. Not only that, reproduce themselves and grow and what have you. So we know it can be done. There's no laws that will prevent us from doing it. How long do I think it will take us to create a really, you know, brand new technology of the equivalent sophistication of life that doesn't really just use the bits that life has already developed? That's probably very, very far in the future, you know, hundreds of years. However, things that sort of mix things we know how to manufacture with something like the Cornell Nanofabrication Facility and biological units and subunits, things that nanometer scale machines that know how to do certain tasks, hybrid structures between living and non-living systems will become more and more prominent, you know, starting from now and just getting growing in number as time goes on.
We were talking somewhat facetiously earlier about nano tweezers, but really I'm kind of curious. You said that to make these nanotubes, you lay down a sheet of a single layer of atoms of carbon and then roll it up. And I can conceptualize that, but what's involved actually in doing that? How do you manipulate these single these sheets and these tubes once you've made them?
That's a really good question, and I kind of told you a white lie. We don't actually take a sheet and roll it up. It grows in a cylindrical form, and it the way it does it, it's kind of like a blade of grass growing out of a seed. One starts with a little metal particle that's called a catalyst particle that basically acts like a sponge for carbon atoms. They sort of soak it like water would soak a sponge, and then they begin to link up and form this graphite-like paper structure, wrap around the particle, and then grow away from it like a, you know, like a soda straw with a little pea stuck in the end of it. And they just grow off from that. And the way we make our devices, we let this thing grow on a substrate, on some surface, and then we build the rest of the device around the nanotube. So we don't have to move it. We let it lay where it wants to lay, and we build our world around it.
I'm wondering if any, I mean, are you working at a level of physics that the laws, you know, the sort of the large-scale laws of physics work, or when you get down to nanolayers, do you start getting into quantum effects where your physical properties are not quite the same as they are in the big world out here?
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question with many different answers. The mechanical properties, you know, if you want to describe this thing as a vibrating string, at the level we're doing things, you can still treat it using sort of macroscopic models, you know, the equations you write down to govern a guitar string and with suitable modifications will work here. The electrons that are running through the string, on the other hand, you have to treat quantum mechanical. You would never understand them using strictly classical ideas.
I see. Are these carbon nanotubes, can they be conductors or semiconductors, or can you use them like an electronic device like that?
A remarkable thing about the nanotubes, in addition to being one of the strongest material known, they're also an extraordinarily good electrical conductor and can be made into transistors, just like you can make silicon into transistors. And in fact, we use that property of the nanotube, the fact that it's an active electronic device, to sense its own motion. When it wiggles up and down, its conductance changes, and we measure that change in conductance, and that's how we know it's wiggling.
What is the history? I mean, how long have people been, you know, you said Cornell's been working on this, but when was the first nanotube fabricated?
Nanotubes were in essence discovered about a little over a decade ago. Someone was just looking in an electron microscope and saw one, so it grew by accident. Once it had been spotted, people figured out different ways to grow them, and it's been an explosive area of research for the last decade. People in physics, chemistry, engineering, biology, everyone is interested, companies from Intel on down have expressed, have started research programs in this phenomenal new material. This is just one more interesting thing you can do with it.
Right. So is there a bottleneck? I mean, people are, you know, is it just the bottleneck of human creativity to figure out how to use these more widely? Because right now they seem to be limited to sort of scientific and, laboratory applications.
The main thing holding us back at the moment is our ability to manipulate the material in some sense, like we were talking about earlier. We can grow it, but it turns out to be a big tangled mess. Imagine a bunch of fishing line that had become tangled. Very hard to work with. What we don't know how to do is to, for example, grow a nanotube and roll it up on a nice little cylinder like a thread on a bobbin, or, you know, make a nanotube grow from here to there in exactly the way we want it to. So it's really the manufacturing technology that keeps us from trying to use this in more near-term applications. Having said that, there's a first application coming out in the near future where they're going to be used as field emitters in a flat-screen television display.
So field emitters? Wait, we better stop.
Yeah.
Going a little too fast there.
This one takes us on a little aside. But imagine that you have a nanotube just poking out like a whisker or something. If you put a voltage on a plate nearby it, you can suck electrons off the end of the nanotube, sort of an inverse lightning rod. And those electrons can run off and hit a screen and light it up, just like that happens in your CRT, your cathode ray tube.
Uh-huh.
And people have found that they're very good field emitters. They're very useful for this application. And as I said, the first products either are out or should be out very soon.
We're talking with Dr. Paul McEwen about a nanotube that he's fabricated that can be plucked like a guitar string, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Could you use this in a radio device, these nanotubes, if they're capable of working at a particular frequency?
In fact, you could certainly imagine doing that. The frequency of the devices that we fabricated tends to be up in the tens to hundreds of megahertz range, which is about where FM radio lives. So they're vibrating out there at the same kind of frequencies that the electromagnetic waves that make up FM radio do. And in fact, the way we listen to the nanotube is much the same way that you would listen to a radio broadcast. We take that high-frequency signal and we sort of convert it down to a lower frequency where it's simpler for us to hear. So you could imagine in the future using these nanotubes as a kind of a simplified radio receiver. And the hope would be that if you could build such a thing, it might be much lower power and simpler than an existing radio.
Interesting. Let's take a call. Let's go to Mike in Columbus, Ohio. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's your question?
Well, Dr. Abbott, my question was, is what do you feel is the time frame and the current status of the research that's going to lead to us getting useful work out of these systems, such as transmissions and the other kind of things that we take for granted on a macro scale that are so very difficult to develop on this scale? Because I'm hearing about these vibrating strings, and conceptually I think of them as a possibility for a transmission-style device or something that might bring us closer to getting useful work on nanoscale. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you. Transmission devices, do you understand how he was talking about that?
I'll assume that he was talking about them sort of again in the radio context, mm-hmm. being a device that could either receive or perhaps transmit electromagnetic radiation, so could talk back and forth like your cell phone does.
Right.
I think right now, again, because of the manufacturing problems, this particular application of using nanotubes in this way is probably far in the future. I certainly wouldn't invest my money in the startup company designed to make money off this. I think in the near term, it's mostly going to be science, and by near term, I mean 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
In other areas, nanotubes, as I said, are already coming to commercial fruition.
What about your own research goals? What's up next for you?
So we use these nanotubes for all kinds of things. In this particular experiment, one of the things we want to do is try to weigh individual atoms, like I was talking to you before.
Mm-hmm.
If we could find a way of gluing an atom or a molecule on the tube, could we change, detect the frequency shift and measure, you know, how much it weighs? That would be just, again, a sort of a scientific fun thing to do. Another thing that we want to study in the very near future is if you get these devices at low temperature, you can watch individual electrons hop onto and off of the nanotube and measure the forces that those single electrons hopping produce on the vibrating nanotube. So basically couple our guitar string to single electrons plinking it.
Hmm. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this segment. Maybe we need a nanotube vibrating to tell us how much time is left. That's probably what we need next. But anyway, I'd like to thank my guest, Paul McEwen. He's a professor of physics in the Laboratory of Atomic and Solid-State Physics at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Thanks for joining me today.
It was my pleasure.
And when we come back, we switch from tiny tubes to tiny wires and what they might be used for in medicine. Stay with us. We're talking this hour about nanotechnology, and now turning away from tiny tubes to tiny wires. Charles Lieber is the Mark Hyman Jr. Professor of Chemistry in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and one of the authors of a paper published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences describing a way to make semiconducting nanowires, tiny slivers of material, be useful for the detection and identification of viruses. He joins me by phone from his office at Harvard. Welcome to the program, Dr. Lieber.
Okay, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we'd like you to join our conversation. Our number to call is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. I guess it's easier enough to say talk there. And so, Dr. Lieber, tell me about this sliver of material that you've made. First of all, how big is it? And how does it detect a virus?
All right. The material wires that we make are actually quite similar in dimensions to the carbon nanotubes that you were discussing in the previous talk. They have diameters on the range of a couple of nanometers, similar to that of DNA, and they're made by a process that we developed several years ago. The material that we actually used in the studies described in this paper is based on silicon, these nanoscale dimensions, and the way that these wires work is really quite simple. It's a, in essence, what you can think about is having this very small wire acting as sort of a switch, and then when something binds to it, it can change the resistance or conductance of that wire, either turning it on or off. The more detailed explanation is that it's configured as a transistor, but rather than operating this transistor as in your computer or a future nanocomputer, we're actuating it by the binding of a biological molecule, in this case a virus.
So how do you get, what are the properties of a nano wire that allow a virus to bind to it?
So the properties of the nanowire itself are not ones that allow one to get selective binding of a biological molecule like a virus to it. The wire itself serves as a ultra-sensitive transducer of an electrical signal. And what provides us with this selectivity to recognize one virus out of a whole soup of many different species, biological species, for instance, in your blood is a very familiar species to biologists, a antibody, which can be generated to be highly selective for one particular type of viral species or viral threat. And so these antibodies are linked using chemistry to the surface of the nanowire that creates the functioning device. The virus can bind to this antibody. The binding event is then sensed electrically by the change in the conductance of the nanoscale silicon wire.
We're talking with Dr. Charles Lieber at Harvard University about a nanowire with an antibody attached to it that can bind to a particular virus that can change the, I guess, the conductance, is that right?
The conductance or resistance.
The conductance or resistance of the wire that that can then be used as a very sensitive virus detector. And we'd like you to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Tell me, then, you have really two fabrication problems. First of all, you have the fabrication problem of making your nanowire, and then you have the problem of attaching the antibody to it. I mean, were they equally difficult challenges, or once you had the wire, was it easy to stick on the antibody?
So I think the development of the nanoscale device, this nanoscale silicon wire transistor, was actually the greatest technical challenge in really advancing that to the level where it is sensitive enough to detect this binding of a single virus is where the major advance is. The chemistry required to link antibodies to that is really an adaptation of work that's been is used now widely in biology and chemistry for screening of different kinds of biological molecules.
Right. So you've got this nanowire with these antibodies waiting for a viral particle to come into play. How do you know you're actually able to find the viruses if they're there? I mean, how do you know they're there? You know, I mean, how do you test the system?
So the motivation for this is there are many techniques for detecting things, but generally they involve quite a bit of chemistry to link reporters, for instance, optical probes. And the whole idea behind creating a powerful, you know, a diagnostic which can tell you if something there is in real time is to get away from any sample modification to be able to look at it. So in essence, what we're asking is, can we detect an electrical signal which corresponds to this binding? And so initially one would see these changes in the conductance with something coming on and then the conductance going back or the resistance going back to the resting state. And one being critical could say, well, how do you know that's not just noise?
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually did some very sophisticated experiments where we used a purified virus which had a color label attached to it and measured the electrical signal while simultaneously in a optical microscope, very sophisticated optical microscope that could literally look at one virus at a time, visualize this virus, and we could demonstrate unambiguously that this red virus, for instance, came down drifted through solution, bound to the surface of the wire, and when it did that, the electrical signal changed that we measured, and when it unbound from the surface of the wire, and you could see this colorful virus moving away, that the electrical signal went back down. And from those kinds of experiments, that one can be confident that the electrical signals that you're measuring actually indeed correspond to the binding and unbinding of an individual virus.
It's just remarkable that you can do it on that scale. Well, let's invite our listeners to join this conversation. Let's go to Frank in Cottonwood, Arizona. Frank, welcome to the program.
And thank you for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener here.
Oh, well, great. And what's your question today?
Well, if you can detect a virus and the virus will bind to the wire, the nanowire, couldn't you oscillate that wire at a fairly good frequency and destroy the virus?
Interesting. Dr. Lieber, what about that?
The wires that were, the way the devices are configured, they're not configured in a way, they're actually supported on a larger substrate, so they couldn't be vibrated if one detected it and then could in principle apply some kind of voltage to, which would in essence lyse or destroy the virus in that way. That would be something possible. I think in the end, what maybe you're getting at is trying to combine this, and maybe I shouldn't get ahead, but it's possible to do something to that. But in the end, if one's thinking about using this both as a test and a sort of treatment or a therapy, if you like, I think you still need to recognize that there's, you can detect one virus, but there's probably many more that are around, and sampling every one of them is still going to be difficult. So my feeling is a better strategy would be as if you could detect at this earliest stage when perhaps the body's immune system was still holding these viruses in check, you could then administer medication which was effective before the virus started replicating rapidly and became highly infectious or into a highly infectious stage.
I'd say I'm thinking somewhat down the road here. Nanotechnology is a marvelous world, and it's going to be the world of our futures. There's no doubt about that. As far as medical machines are concerned, it opens an incredible vista to us.
Well, Frank, thanks very much for that call. We're talking with Dr. Charles Lieber from Harvard University about his nanoviral detector, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Mark in Lansing, Michigan. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for taking my call on this open forum. I would like to contradict the previous discussion almost in its entirety. I'm sorry I didn't get the professor's name exactly from Harvard, but I think it's all hogwash as far as real-world application. Let me give you an example. Let's say that I snap the antenna off of my 1986 Pontiac Firebird. I could take a 100-yard length of duct tape, most of us know what duct tape is, and stretch it across the junkyard and maybe come up with something that would indicate an antenna for my car.
Well, Mark,
Similarly, I could go out in the junkyard and look for an 86 Firebird and take an antenna off of there. What I'm saying is it's all theoretical. It's interesting, but it has no real application.
Well, Mark, that's an interesting point, but it seems to me, Dr. Lieber, that it's more than theoretical. You've actually used this thing as a detector right now, haven't you?
Let me just tell you, at the NPR website, there's a copy or a link to this manuscript that was published, and in this paper, we have in fact shown that you can take real-world samples, which are not purified viruses but contain many other species, and selectively detect single viruses within that. That solution could contain several different types of viruses, and in fact, at the end of this paper, we demonstrate, and I, still find this quite, remarkable in an indication of what will change diagnostics in this area that we could simultaneously detect two distinct types of viruses using a single device, which could be, based on other work in the field, be scaled to detecting many viruses simultaneously at a level that just isn't accessible today.
Well, that's the point, I guess, is that this is something that could detect a virus in real time, rather than having to run back to the laboratory and with a sample and see if you had something.
So I think that really has, you know, significant potential impact in healthcare as well as in issues of biowarfare detection.
So you're thinking of this primarily right now as a detector, or do you think there? I mean, we heard about someone suggesting it, you know, combining it somehow as both a detector and a destroyer. But do you see this mostly as a detection technology, or do you see a different future application for it?
I think if one is realistic about the difficulties of actually building, you know, engineering something reliable, the near term is where one should focus, is on the unique detection capabilities. And there's examples in our recent history, very recent history, such as SARS epidemic and elsewhere, where something like this kind of detection capability could have changed quite a bit the ability to mediate or moderate the spread of this type of viral infection. And I think people are going to be interested, you know, when you have something very simple that can impact this kind of generic medical problem and, you know, potentially, you know, I think for a very positive benefit for society. So I think that's a really good thing. Coupling it to more sophisticated kinds of problems in treatment, I think, is something to think about as a scientist down the road, but in terms of where people are going to see nanotechnology or nanoscience impact a real technology and application, I think it's the simpler thing that we should think about for the near term and try to focus on.
Okay. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it today. Thanks, Dr. Lieber, very much for talking with us.
Thanks. Pleasure.
Charles Lieber is the Mark Hyman Jr. Professor of Chemistry in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Earlier, I spoke with Paul McEwen. He's a professor of physics in the Laboratory of Atomic and Solid-State Physics at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and with David Lindstrom, the Genesis Program scientist at NASA. Thanks to all of them for joining me today. Kevin Waite is our technical director. Our audio engineer is Vince Muse in Washington. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Keem Malesky and Alphonse Vinn, and from engineer Bert Reed in Ithaca. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. You can also email us at our internet address, which is scifry@npr.org, or surf over and visit us at our website at www.sciencefriday.com. Ira Flatow will be back next week. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.